From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Islamic State militants release a new video that claims to show a captured British journalist as President Obama builds international support for action against ISIS extremists.
There are more than 40 countries so far that have offered assistance to the broad campaign against ISIL. France in particular has some sophisticated intelligence and surveillance capability that has already been put to good use.
Also today, Amnesty International say torture and brutality have become common practice for both the country's military and police in Nigeria. And Scotland holds its breath as the independence referendum votes are counted.
Really, at the moment, it's a nightmare for ministers here in London.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Scots are voting on whether to become independent from the rest of the UK. Over 4 million people registered to vote, and a high turnout is expected. The referendum would see the breakaway of Scotland from the United Kingdom after 300 years of union. Polls close at 10 p.m. local time. Ollie Barrett is at the Scottish Parliament at Holyrood.
Very lively atmosphere in the centre of Edinburgh. The Yes campaigners and the No campaigners are still out in force. The Yes campaign perhaps more visible, but the No campaign just as passionate. And both sides know that one of them is going to be very disappointed come tomorrow morning. And the polls have been incredibly close, so neither side is completely confident.
The president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, has requested additional U.S. military equipment and a special security status. Petro Poroshenko made the plea for help in countering the influence of Russian-backed rebels during an address to a joint session of the U.S. Congress. He's also asking for non-military aid and further political support from the U.S., including further sanctions against Russia. But Mr. Poroshenko says he will continue to push for a peace deal.
I am ready to do my utmost to avoid the further escalation and casualties, even at this point when the war has already started feeding on itself. Sooner or later, I am absolutely sure, peace will return to the Ukrainian homes. And despite the insanity of this war, I am convinced that the peace can be achieved sooner rather than later. I strongly encourage the United States to give Ukraine a special security and defense status, which reflect the highest level of interaction with non-NATO ally.
Islamic State militants have released a videotape showing a kidnapped British reporter who says he's being held by the group. John Cantley disappeared in Syria in November 2012. In a scripted message that he reads to camera, he says he will be presenting a series of programs in the next few days that will convey some facts to Western audiences about the Islamic State.
I know what you're thinking. You're thinking he's only doing this because he's a prisoner. He's got a gun at his head and he's being forced to do this, right? Well, it's true. I am a prisoner. That I cannot deny. But seeing as I've been abandoned by my government and my fate now lies in the hands of the Islamic State, I have nothing to lose.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. U.S. lawmakers have backed a plan to arm Syrian rebels fighting Islamic State militants by an overwhelming bipartisan majority. The 273-156 vote in the House of Representatives lends U.S. President Barack Obama the support he needs to battle ISIS without putting boots on the ground. From Washington, Nina Maria Potts reports.
Deep divisions over how far the U.S. should go in combating Islamic State militants meant Wednesday's vote to train and back Syrian rebels was highly contentious and not at all certain. But an unlikely alliance emerged in the House of Representatives backing the military move. It also came as President Obama laid out his long-term strategy for crushing Islamic State militants, which shuts the door on a combat mission, a prospect raised by his top military chiefs just a day earlier. President Obama lobbied lawmakers not to undermine him as he tries to recruit international support to take on ISIS in what he describes as a sustained campaign of airstrikes. But whether that does in fact constitute an act of war is being hotly debated on Capitol Hill. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
And Amnesty International has released a report slamming Nigeria's police and military for what it says is the routine torture of men, women, and children as young as 12. The report found that up to 10,000 people have been arrested since 2009, and many have died in random executions in prison. From Abuja, Gary Alfonso reports.
Nigerian authorities have not yet responded to the Amnesty International report, which was compiled through hundreds of interviews over the past 7 years. The report states that torture has become such an integral part of policing in Nigeria that many stations have an informal torture officer. The report highlights that both the military and police regularly use methods like beating, nail and teeth extractions, and sexual violence to obtain information or confessions. The use of torture is particularly extreme in northeastern Nigeria in the war against Boko Haram Islamist militants. Gary Alfonso, Abuja.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. After President Obama rejected U.S. boots on the ground in Iraq, it's now down to the Senate after the House of Representatives approved Mr. Obama's plan to arm the moderate Syrian opposition in their battle against the Islamic State. Secretary of State John Kerry thanked House members for their backing of hundreds of millions of dollars to train and arm the Syrian rebels.
Stepping up the efforts with respect to the moderate opposition is an essential piece of any strategy against ISIL.
The reach of IS has also been felt in Australia, where more than 800 officers were involved in counter-terrorism raids, with intelligence suggesting IS was planning a violent attack in the country. For more analysis on this fast-moving global response to the Islamic State militants, Nick Ferrari spoke to military expert Frank Ledwidge.
No one can find the moderate Syrian opposition. You know, effectively, it doesn't exist as an effective military force. If the US and its allies are serious in dealing with this IS threat, insofar as it's a threat to us, then they need to engage with the serious players. And in the Syrian area, because of course many people in the region don't acknowledge borders, that's the Syrian army and organizations such as the PKK, which are also unpalatable because they're currently listed as terrorist groups. They're the really effective anti-IS military units, military bodies.
So am I hearing from you then that we might be talking about boots on the ground?
No, that'd be the last thing that would have any proper effect. There are some problems to which the answer is not the US Marine Corps or the US Army, or at least of all our army, with respect to this, doesn't do us any good.
Right.
No, there needs to be a realism applied to this, and I think there is, you know, on the quiet. They're not going to admit to it. There are certainly talks going on with the Syrian government. The Iranians have to be engaged in this. But most importantly, what we've really got to avoid here is the appearance of aligning against the Sunni people, because that's a recruiting sergeant for IS. That's why these horrible murders are taking place, is to lure us in, because there's nothing they want more than British and American planes overhead helping Shia soldiers in front as ISIS fight them.
So they are fought how?
They have to be fought through proxies. They have to be fought in a realistic way. As I say, this is essentially a 10-way civil war we're getting involved in. I must admit, I'm slightly confused as to where our national interests are in it, but let's assume there are national interests. We need to be extremely careful what the optics are. That's vital. And by optics, I mean what we're seen to be doing. And we can't be seen to be... You talk about boots on the ground. You know, there's other ways of putting overt military force in. There's roundels and RAF tornadoes and typhoons overhead, too. Because that pretty much, you know, will have this similar results in terms of the optics, in terms of what appears to be happening to the people on the ground. What will appear to be happening is that we'll be lining up alongside all the enemies of the Sunni people who've had it really, really bad for the last 23 years since we started bombing Iraq in 1991.
Frank Ledwidge, a barrister and former military officer who has served in the Balkans, Iraq and Afghanistan, speaking on LBC Radio. And FSN Reports looks at the global recruitment to the ranks of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria later in the show. This is FSN Reports. as Scots went to the polls to vote on whether they would become an independent nation, people in other parts of the United Kingdom watched on anxiously. A yes vote would present a new set of security questions for the UK and could also cost Prime Minister David Cameron his political future. Iris Spitzer reports from London.
The Scottish flag is flying over Downing Street, but for how much longer?
I have to tell you what that would mean.
Perhaps no one is watching more closely than British Prime Minister David Cameron, who on Wednesday admitted to some nervousness.
Of course, everyone who cares about our United Kingdom, and I care passionately about our United Kingdom, is nervous, but I'm confident that we've set out how Scotland can have the best of both worlds, a successful economy with the growing number of jobs we see today.
However, some lawmakers have questioned whether David Cameron can remain as Prime Minister in the event of a yes vote. Journalist Alex Stevenson explains.
David Cameron would face an unprecedented constitutional crisis if Scotland votes yes. It's going to be a huge challenge for the British government. And I think really, at the moment, it's a nightmare for ministers here in London.
Some analysts, like Douglas Murray from the Henry Jackson Society, have also expressed concern about Britain's future security in the event of a yes vote.
If Scotland did pursue entirely separate security policies, as the Scottish Nationalists say they will, then it's impossible. You couldn't have a border. You would need a border to make sure that we knew in the rest of the United Kingdom who was coming in here, which security threats that the Scots may not care about at all, but that we would very much care about.
Despite the lack of rallies and flags, the future of the United Kingdom is a question on the minds of those in the remaining parts of the UK who have no say in the outcome. For now, those south of the border can only wait for their Scottish cousins to decide if they're staying with the Union or going their own way. Iris Spitzer, London.
Now, Nigeria's police and military routinely torture women, men and children, some as young as 12, using a wide range of methods, including beatings, shootings and rape. That's according to a report by Amnesty International. The findings detail how people are often detained in large dragnet operations and tortured as punishment to extort money or to extract confessions. The Nigerian government has not yet responded to the accusations. With more, our Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso.
Well, it's clear that from 2007, Amnesty International has apparently been coming to Nigeria to conduct surveys and interviews and reports on alleged torture in Nigerian prisons and also in military barracks and in security installations. And what they've found are those horrific reports that they've now released, or facts that they've put together in a report stating that up to 10,000 people may have been brutally tortured between 2007 and 2014 this year, and in many cases people are dying indiscriminately and being executed in very overcrowded prisons, and that the security situation in Nigeria has really almost given some kind of blanket ruling in the military and in the police that the interrogation of people and torture of people to obtain information regarding the Islamic insurgency in the north of the country by Islamic extremists is a serious point of concern. So as far as that is concerned, the Amnesty International report also states that the security situation is exacerbating the problem, but that it has become commonplace and a point of concern for the Nigerian authorities, and something that they must take serious notice of.
And have Amnesty International elaborated on the types of torture methods they claim have been used by the military and the police? And what reaction, if any, have we had from the Nigerian government to these damning accounts?
We've not received any specific confirmation or comment from the Nigerian authorities yet, but what we do understand is that there is a very specific method of torture that is being applied specifically by the military in the northeast of Nigeria, where the Boko Haram threat is obviously running very high, and that threat has given seemingly the military authorities and also the local police stations almost some kind of amnesty themselves from the local authority or the rule of law in Nigeria as far as extracting information. In some cases, children as young as 12 are being tied
tied up and held upside down, their hands and wrists tied with barbed wire, in some cases losing limbs. In other cases, extreme forms of sexual torture, particularly of women, and very extreme and brutal forms of torture, all to try and obviously extract information out of local people who might have knowledge about the insurgents living in the area, or perhaps family members that might have joined other groups, etc. So it's a serious point of concern, and something that the Nigerian authorities will no doubt release some information on in the coming days, but nothing so far, and perhaps it just speaks to exactly how widespread this problem might be.
And Gary, lastly, you've covered events and stories across Nigeria. Do you think there's a sense that the Ebola crisis, which Nigeria has also been pulled into, has overshadowed what is still a very ongoing, violent, restive situations, particularly in the northeast of the country?
One can perhaps feel that Nigeria is really getting it from the north and from the south, with the Ebola virus coming in from the southern parts of Nigeria. But there's always been the underlying issue in Nigeria that the northeast is the major threat to the country, where Islamic extremists are trying to establish some kind of caliphate or even some kind of permanent presence, and the Nigerian military authorities not able to deal with the heavily armed rebels. And that's perhaps part of the reason why there's some indiscriminate treatment of people in prisons and people being interrogated going on, because it is a battle. Everyone senses that the Nigerian authorities are not on top of 100%, and that perhaps the extreme measures being taken, not only in trying to extract information or the so-called confessions out of people, is part of the larger ongoing problem. So yes, perhaps Nigeria getting it from several fronts, and with an election looming next year, many feel that unless there's a clear sign that the military is dealing with the Boko Haram issue militarily and not with all kinds of other issues, as we are talking about these police torture methods, etc., unless it's dealt with very forcefully in the northeast of the country, the problem is not going to get away, and perhaps could be causing other social issues, which are very evident, as with this Amnesty International report.
FSN's Africa correspondent Gary Alfonso. This is FSN Reports. IS militants have released a new video that claims to show a captured British journalist. The video shows a man identified as John Cantley saying he was kidnapped by jihadists in Syria 2 years ago. Mr. Cantley says he'll soon reveal facts about ISIS to counter the way the extremist group is being portrayed by Western media.
I know what you're thinking. You're thinking he's only doing this because he's a prisoner. He's got a gun at his head and he's being forced to do this, right? Well, it's true. I am a prisoner. That I cannot deny. But seeing as I've been abandoned by my government and my fate now lies in the hands of the Islamic State, I have nothing to lose.
ISIS has recently released videos showing the beheading of two American journalists and a British aid worker. The White House, meanwhile, applauded France's decision to join the US airstrikes against ISIS targets in Iraq. Presidential spokesperson Josh Earnest said the US looks forward to coordinating efforts with France to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS. The US says some 40 nations have offered various types of assistance in the emerging fight. For more analysis on the foundations of the IS and how their ranks are being swelled by a global recruitment drive, FSN's Washington correspondent Simon Marks spoke to Jocelyn Cesari, a senior fellow at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center, where she directs the Islam in World Politics program. And she began by telling him about the contradictory ideology of the IS movement.
So what they are projecting on their vision of Islam is also a modern nation state project. And that's the danger of it, because it is a very, as I said, totalitarian, intolerant project, like we had in the past. If you think of the communist period or even of the Nazi projection, this kind of experience where you have the goal to make everybody the same in one portion of territory. And again, I don't think that they have the means right now to become a caliphate in the sense of multi-territorial or, covering a huge amount of territory outside the region in which they are operating. I don't think it's more symbolic reference.
Does the language matter? I mean, do you think they are using this phrase Islamic State, the word caliphate, deliberately? I mean, this is carefully chosen language. Does it matter in
it
terms
does,
of?
It does, absolutely. I mean, lots of the legitimacy, I would say credibility of all this political Islam group have been, their legitimacy is about using terms that can attest or show their authenticity. So the more terms from the tradition you use, even if you don't use them the same way they were, the more authentic and true Muslim you look.
And from the study that you've made of this, where do you come down on the debate over whether Islamic State in its current form or its form over the short term has the potential to be a really global threat as opposed to a regional threat?
I would say that over the last 20 years, what we have seen is most of the time regional destabilization exploited or instrumentalized by global transnational movement. I mean, Al-Qaeda is the prototype or the best example, so to speak, or more representative example of this kind of strategy. In other words, most of the conflicts remain regional. If you look at the Israelo-Palestinian conflict, if you look at Afghanistan, Pakistan, if you look now Syria, Iraq, but on the ground of this regional conflict, some transnational group with a global vision, Al-Qaeda was and remains, to my knowledge, the only one with this vision of a global jihad that has no goal whatsoever, even if they can also refer to the caliphate. They have no intention to build a political system. The goal is to destroy the existing international system.
So when you read the kind of articles that Tom Friedman has written most recently in the New York Times, in which he raises the question of, you know, should the United States actually be worried about this? Should it be doing anything about this? Where do you come down in that debate?
I think the United States should be worried about the regional consequences and the destabilization happening in the region. It is not a direct threat to the national integrity or national sovereignty of the U.S. Even if you look at the way that Al-Qaeda has destabilized, and I'm not talking about the 9/11 attack, that in the current conditions, I'm not convinced it's possible to happen again. But if you look at the evolution of jihad in the West, for example, in Europe over the last 10 years since 9/11, you see that you have isolated attempts, and also in the US, by the way, to do some damage. But you do not have a logistic or a strategy that would lead to take over the country.
And do you think that while clearly the United States has the capacity to damage Islamic State from the air, does it have the capacity on the ground, not in a combat mode, but in an intellectual mode, to damage the organization by countering the arguments that it's making and winning hearts and minds as opposed to losing them to Islamic State?
Actually, the U.S. did succeed in the past in this disentanglement between a jihadist discourse and the Sunni population. It was at the time of 2006-2007 was the Sawa, the resurgence. And what the military did at the time was clearly to disconnect the tribal Sunni Islam from the Al-Qaeda activists. But it was a different condition. The military was present at the time. So the best way to go would be to bring in religious voices, but not only Sunni, also Shia. If we want to maintain the unity of Iraq, it's really about bringing everybody to the table and having credible authorities, you know, also intellectuals. It doesn't have to be clerics automatically, but talking from a religious point of view that can and that have social legitimacy that can undermine this political and religious project.
And with regard to the capacity of Islamic State to recruit supporters from the West, is there... How would you identify the attractiveness of Islamic State to Western Muslims, and how should the West go about countering that?
There is definitely an attractiveness. By the numbers that are today tracked by the different European governments, from Germany, the UK, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, this is the highest number of young people taking on the jihad outside Europe. Far higher than what happened, for example, in Afghanistan or even in other destabilized areas before. So this is something serious, and I think there is a clear appeal of the IS message toward young Muslims in Europe, because they are providing a sort of vision of the world and also status of Islam that can explain why they are themselves discriminated. And the reason here is more about symbolic discrimination than socioeconomic. We should not think that because Muslims in Europe are sometimes disenfranchised or vulnerable, socioeconomically speaking, that they are more, I would say, easier target to IS. Actually, what we see is that the young people who get into this kind of jihad are more educated and more middle class than we think they are. So it's about the symbolic deficit, the sense that they don't fit. And the more the contemporary political discourse about Islam in Europe goes on, and if we follow that, we can see that there are more and more discussion and question on the practice of Islam as a religion, from halal food to circumcision to dress code. This is touching on a very sensitive nerve among Muslims who think that they are citizens, but also Muslims in these countries.
But if Islamic State is successfully recruiting from the ranks of not just people who feel disenfranchised economically, but, you know, one sees reports of medical students from
Absolutely.
Britain, you know,
yes,
giving
yeah.
up potentially yes. professional careers in Western Europe. I mean, that must make it exponentially harder for Western governments to counter that.
It is absolutely true. I would say that the problem of Europe is a very critical one, in the sense that if you look at the amount of policy that have been done by European governments, all of them, to integrate Muslims, we cannot say, sometimes I hear from this side of the Atlantic, that Europe doesn't do anything. It's not completely true. There are tons of urban development initiative, economic initiative, but the question is, what do they do to integrate or include Islam in the national narrative of their country? It's another issue, which is about how do I make room, and not only a socioeconomic or material room, but also a symbolic room for people who are still seen, because they identify to Islam, as alien groups or alien individual or coming, you know, from overseas.
FSN's Washington correspondent Simon Marks speaking with Jocelyn Cesari, a senior fellow at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center, where she directs the Islam in World Politics program. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the program by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.